Is it becoming next to impossible to decrypt information? Hi, this is Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. Listen to Canadian Intelligence Aid. Over the years you've been listening to me, you've learned, or maybe you probably already knew if you were a practitioner, that there's different ways of gathering intelligence. There's human intelligence. This is where you task somebody to find out something about, an organized gang or maybe a terrorist cell or et cetera, et cetera. There's also what we largely call signals intelligence. And this is where you can do one of two things. You can kind of vacuum the air and see what you get in terms of communications sent back and forth, emails, web pages, et cetera. Or you can go to court if you're a security intelligence service or law enforcement, apply for a warrant, a much more targeted effort to get someone's communications. And there's kind of two ways of looking at communications as they're sent. There's open communications, so things like web pages, emails, Facebook pages, etc. And there's the other kind. Now, if you're a bad guy, the last thing you want is for somebody who's on the good side to know what you're saying, why you're saying it, and what it means. So you tend to use technology that obfuscates the signal. And one of those technologies, of course, is encryption. I'm going to turn to this notion of encryption again with my guest, Richard Brisson. He joined me way back. It was 3 years ago, actually. It was in February of 2021. Richard and I worked together at CSC, Communication Security Establishment. He retired from there in 2011. While he was there, he was involved with various fields of mathematics and computer science. He's also a graduate of the National Security Agency, which is the United States Signals Intelligence Organization, 3-year cryptologic mathematics program, and he's got the coolest collection of vintage cryptographic and clandestine artifacts that I've ever seen and I've had the pleasure of looking at. And we're going to talk about sort of where cryptanalysis is going. So, Richard, it's been a long time, but welcome back to the podcast. Let's start with an education question, Richard. For my listeners who've never been involved in this kind of activity, and for the record, I did spend a year working with you in the old crypt shop at CSE. What are the basic principles behind encryption and decryption?
The further back you go in history, the simpler the systems. Like I could mention, like everybody has likely heard of the Caesar cipher, where basically every letter in the Roman alphabet is replaced by the third furthest in the alphabet. Right. So it's a key of three.
Not very sophisticated. It's pretty easy to figure out once you've got
anybody getting, you know, an enciphered message using the Caesar cipher is probably wondering, what the heck is this? By today's terms, that would not do. So as time evolves, of course, everything gets a little more complex. You know, you've had the hand systems, you've got the substitution systems, you've got then the transposition, which all hand, the one-time pads, which are rooted in hand systems. But they also evolve with now, like World War I, World War II brings about machine ciphers. And those get very complicated, so much so that those involved in breaking these machines back in the day are saying, oh, that's the end of breaking anything. These things are too complicated. But like Bletchley Park discovered, if you bring in not just analysts or linguists, but bring in mathematicians and people who have a knack for designing algorithms, much like computer science does, then you can create novel things, which of course happened at Bletchley Park.
Right.
And of course, if you come towards today and beyond, I think that's there'll be a topic you'll be discussing is quantum cryptography. So, and that gets fairly complex.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Now, you mentioned Bletchley Park. This, of course, was the effort by the Allies during the Second World War to look at German and Japanese ciphers. And in fact, there was success in many ways, if correct me if I'm wrong, due to Polish mathematicians that had escaped Poland before the Germans invaded to be able to read the Enigma machine, which was a key element to our ability to understand what Germans' intentions were, as well as, I believe, one of the Japanese naval codes. Would you call that, Richard, is it fair to say that that period during the Second World War where we had great successes against our enemy cyber
system,
was that a golden age
because,
of cryptanalysis?
There have been so many books, there have been plays, and of course The Imitation Game that's been produced as a movie. I even give talks on titled The Spectrum Between Fact and Fiction in that movie. And, you know, the movie gets a lot of things right, but there are things that unfortunately it gets very wrong. I'll just mention one. Yeah, that, like Denniston.
It's Hollywood after all, right?
Good, kind-hearted guy, and really in his day, and he was the head of GCNCS. But in the movie, he's portrayed like one evil dude. So anyway, but you're right. The probably the most classic example people tend to know a little bit about, and more, of course, is the Polish successes in the 1930s. And of course, they were able to recover how three rotors recovered. Yeah. As war is ready to break out open, they recover rotors four and five. But there was a way that the Germans were using their Enigma that allowed them to do that by just intercepting traffic. But World War II breaks out, and it's a different story. The British have to resort to a good old-fashioned way, which is steal the rest of the rotors.
Well, sometimes you do what you have to do, right? So really, without the contribution of the Poles in the Enigma decryption effort, do you think it would have been impossible for the Allies to get in?
I think they would have gotten in. There would have been a fair delay. But then again, you have to credit the British. They had operation this, operation that. It is absolutely incredible. So it could have been, even Alan, not Alan Turing, but Ian Fleming was involved with some operations to recover Enigma secrets. So who knows? They might have pulled off something he formulated off the shelf and tried to. Now, of course, there's a story which some of us are not quite convinced that Dieppe behind that would have been to recover an Enigma. But that's high risks. If the Germans see you walk away with an Enigma,
I heard that.
You might be in a worse position than you were initially.
Yeah. Because, of course, if the enemy realizes that, A, you have successfully decoded messaging or have understood the algorithm, then, of course, they're going to change the method, which means you're kind of stuck where you were before, right? You're no longer able to access
the British also,
system as it's being used.
Rightfully so. They had decrypts from Enigma, Naval Enigma, and they would tell them the location of U-boats. They just didn't send out everything to take them out. They would send a recon plane very quickly, and the U-boats would we've got spotted, and at least dismiss the possibility that Enigma was behind the intelligence.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Which is really smart, yeah. Obviously, as you said, Richard, I mean, things have changed an awful lot since, you know, your time at CSC, my time at CSC, certainly since the Second World War. I came across a fascinating story the other day, and this isn't really cryptanalysis per se, but I came across this story earlier on this year, and Ottawa police had a cell phone that was locked. It had belonged to a suspect that they were investigating. I believe it was that to do with child pornography. And they got authority to take this cell phone, probably under a court warrant. And they tried to guess the password of this locked cell phone. And apparently they tried 175 million passcodes and were unsuccessful. And the judge finally said, look, you've had your kick of the can, you have to give back. And apparently the possibility of the characters and number combination to break this cell phone passcode was 44 nonillion, and I have no idea. That's a big number. Have we reached a point now where simply the technology is so good that it has become all but impossible for cryptanalysis? I can say classic cryptanalysis, where you have these mass attacks with massive computer power.
At times it does appear that it might be exactly that, but I think because a human component is involved, let me give you the advice for the common Canadian, for example. Hopefully they're using, when they need security, something that does the job. The one most important thing for listeners to and Canadians to know, and I think more and more do, you use a different password, a good different password for every application that you have. Now, that doesn't mean convenience, unfortunately, and that's why so many of us fall in the trap like, oh, I'll use the same password for everything. It's a complicated password, but if they get in anywhere, like you hear, oh, they got hacked here, and if your password is in there, good luck. So, but I'm hoping, and I think the landscape that has changed quite a lot since you and I were there, but you probably saw more from where you were, is the cyber landscape, where many things can happen. I think some government organizations within Canada have certain authorities that allow them to do certain things that they could not in the past. So hopefully that is proving beneficial when it's needed. So, you know, we did have the odd success when we had law enforcement support, but most of them are very challenging. And it's fair to say that the majority, we did not provide any help. It was not either not possible to break it or we could not. Now, we don't give our service unless there is a warrant in place, of course.
Right. Exactly. Now, at the outset, so it's staying along this line of how technology has become more complicated. You mentioned quantum encryption at the outset, and I've heard a lot about this. And I recall being at a talk at CSE in the old Sir Leonard Tilley building. This would have been in the mid to late 90s. I'm not sure if you remember this, but I think we had a gentleman from the United States come up from NSA, and he was talking about how he foresaw that the technology would get so sophisticated to the point where somebody could use this to essentially encode a message, and that message could not be broken, given the technology at the time, even if you were to try, you know, the lifespan of the universe, 13 billion years or whatever we're up to right now, to break that. What do we mean by quantum encryption? And what are the problems if people use quantum encryption in terms of the good guys trying to get at the underlying plain text?
Quantum mechanics, and that is the field that is behind quantum computing and quantum cryptography. Now, we say quantum cryptography because the quantum mechanics are involved in the process, but not necessarily in the encipherment. So far, quantum cryptography is used in the key distribution, much like public key algorithms are used. They are more effective. They have longer key lengths, but they are very laborious in terms, if you were to use them for encrypting information, it would be very, very difficult in terms of bandwidth. So that's why the public key, also quantum key distribution, are interesting constructs in getting keys distributed to where they're needed securely. Now, the only issue with the quantum side is that it's very fast. But I was speaking with a co-speaker at Brock University about a month ago, and he's from the University of Waterloo, Thomas Genwine, and he's involved in a Canadian space agency effort in tandem with the University of Waterloo in a line of sight quantum key distribution from ground to a satellite. Now, currently, the only way to use quantum key distribution has been through fiber, not the line of sight. So, apparently, that's going to be delivered next year. So, sounds very exciting from a Canadian point of view, and from a big step forward in terms of maybe using quantum key distribution in a very novel way.
Right. Now, something I had read once, and I may have gotten it wrong, but it's to do with quantum cryptography or not, is that there's a technology out there that if somebody even attempts to manipulate your message by trying to get the underlying plain text, you know about it. There's somehow that even looking at it, it does something to the actual carrier wave or whatever it is, and the person can decide, yes. I may have been compromised and decide to resend. Does that make any sense to you at all?
Why quantum key distribution is interesting is that if anybody tries to take a look, and if you take a look, that means you're tampering with the photons, they can tell at the other end, oh, somebody's or something's interrupted but you and I perhaps know of what an attacker sometimes does is denial of service. So they just keep on interfering with the signal and therefore no key delivery happens. So, and with the satellite, one has to worry a little bit about that, exactly. Just block the line of sight. The one thing for the common listener who may have, it's challenging to understand quantum mechanics as it's applied to cryptography. There's an interesting set of YouTube videos by Dr. Quantum. He's an animated character, but he does a really great job in explaining some of the basic constructs behind quantum mechanics. So I can encourage your listeners to do that. They might find it entertaining.
I'll definitely put a link to it in the show notes. That sounds really interesting. I'll look at it myself. Now, so are we entering an age now, Richard, where because this is all becoming so complicated and the sheer computer power required to do these things, and you know as well as I did that as the years went on, it got harder and harder and harder to do this. Are we getting to a point where the bad guys are going to sort of have a permanent advantage over the good guys when they truly want to conceal their intent and their messaging?
More or less true. But I know some of the points that you sent to me was the, you know, technology as it evolves. Well, technology does funny things. It will at times improve the cryptography, and at times it will improve the counter cryptography. That means do the code breaking, as opposed to improving the code making. So it's quantum computing,
right?
That looks like it's going to be the pitfall of many current encipherment algorithms, but not all. So, but that is a very complicated field to assess. Now, the one thing that's, I guess for me is a little worrisome is Asia, China, is really made big advancements in quantum cryptography, quantum computing.
Yes.
So we'll have to be very aware of that possibility that we might be at the cusp of being exploited. So hopefully we'll take countermeasures.
Well, and that's a really good point, and I'm really glad you raised it. You know, it's funny, we're of the same vintage, Richard, in that, you know, growing up, anything made in China was kind of a joke, right? It was very cheap, and it was made out of plastic. And now I'm reading in more and more sources that at the cutting edge of technology, that in some ways, China has surpassed much of what the West can do, or is at least at par with us. And as I keep reminding people, you know, China is not our friend, not our ally. We can only see what they're doing here in Canada with harassing dissidents, interfering in our elections, establishing police stations and things like that. So, I think vigilance is the key word here. And maybe an added message we'd like to leave for our listeners is that, you know, maybe you shouldn't be reliant on Chinese technology, i.e. Huawei, for anybody who, you know, read the news over the past couple of years, that we're talking about a government, like I said, that is not is not coherent with our values here in the West, and may in fact be using technology against us as opposed to for us. Last question for you, and I mentioned your rather esoteric collection of cryptographic equipment, as well as sort of spies in the the average public view. You've got great artifacts from a variety of TV shows and things like that. As I mentioned to you and to your wife, I don't know where you're going to find the room to put more stuff, but you're constantly on the look for more information that's generally spy/cryptography related.
More interesting, but history of cryptology in Canada is, you know, like Canada's procured most of its crypto equipment from allies, especially US and British. So there's not that much history here, except that
yeah.
we mentioned University of Waterloo. So out of there came Certicom, Mobius, of course, BlackBerry. So they're interesting Canadian companies still mm-hmm. in business and doing well.
Well, yeah, and it's too bad that you know some of our Canadian successes aren't as well known. And you know, for my listeners who you know couldn't find Canada on a map, let's face it, the Cold War started thanks to Canada with the defection of Igor Gruzenko from the Soviet embassy in the fall of 1945. So Canada does have a role to play amongst not just its Five Eyes allies, but general, you know, wider Western NATO allies as well. Richard, you know what? We had a lot of fun together working together at CSE. I am a great admirer of your collection and your efforts to keep Canadians informed on things surrounding cryptanalysis and Canadian involvement in intelligence. And listen, thank you once again for joining me here on the podcast and providing some insight to my listeners as to you know whether encryption and decryption and what are some of the things we have to worry about. I appreciate you taking the time.
All right, Phil.
I suspect there's going to be a part three down the road sometime. Thanks, Richard. So that was my conversation with Richard Brisson, who worked in cryptanalysis at CSE for many years. Curious what you thought about his comments on the challenges behind, you know, reading what bad guys are saying so that we can allow our security, intelligence, and law enforcement and military protectors to do their jobs. You can reach me on email, borealisrisk@gmail.com or on X at borealissaves. Also find me on LinkedIn and on Facebook. If you like the content, want to get more, go to the website, borealisthreatandrisk.com. Hit a subscribe button. There's no charge. All the podcasts and blogs are there. Love to hear your feedback on what you thought of this, as well as some ideas for future guests. We'll talk again soon. Until then, take care.